What do you think?
If you have a 5-year time frame, it's a no-brainer. I mean, absolutely no-brainer. I'm delighted to see the spot price of uranium decline. I'm happier yet to see the smaller uranium equities decline in price. They got way, way, way ahead of themselves. But when you describe me as a uranium expert, I'm actually a uranium beneficiary. If you look back to what happened to my own portfolio in the last uranium bull market, it was the stuff of legend. It was really, really, really wonderful. And it taught me a lot about markets. And what did Yogi Berra say? Deja vu all over again. We're in a situation now where globally we're using about 200 million pounds, and that number is increasing fairly rapidly.
Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. I am back with Rick Rule. Rick, thanks for coming back on the show.
Steve, thank you for having me back. I enjoy this process.
Yes, I do as well. Let me start out with the big picture view. What is your macro view of the global economy?
You don't have enough time for that. In my experience, Steve, when you have periods of tightening, it's hard on all asset classes. Higher interest rates are hard on all consumers of capital. As an example, in equity markets, higher interest rates raise the cost of capital for companies because if they borrow money, they pay more for it. But they also lower the capitalized value of their distributions. In other words, dividends face more competition from deposit products. So rising interest rates almost always result in lower equity prices. Rising interest rates, too, demolish long-term bond markets. The demolition of long-term bond markets means that companies and entities like governments, which are funding long-term pension plans, need to increase the rate of their contributions to the pension plan, which takes many away from other uses. As credit quality deteriorates, the specter of default and the reality of default, in fact, increases, which damages investor confidence. So my own suspicion is that the next couple of years are going to be pretty challenging. I think in the very short term, in the very, very, very short term, that the market will digest this 75 basis point increase. And the fact that it digested the increase will lead to a sucker rally, a dead cat bounce in stocks. So if you ask me what I think is going to happen in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I wouldn't be surprised to see fairly ebullient conditions in the next 3 or 4 weeks. But to the extent that the voters allow the political class to continue on this road of tapering, which I think, by the way, is a good thing, and continuing on the road to something closer to free market interest rates, I think it's going to be very tough on a wide variety of asset classes. If you want to know how tough, let's play a little mind game. Let's do a little bit of arithmetic. The primary savings and investment instrument in the world, the benchmark security for the entire global economy, is the U.S. 10-year Treasury. Non-Americans will hate that, but it doesn't matter. It's true. That security now is yielding above 3, having gone as low as, 1.1, 1.2 3 years ago. That tells us a couple things. It tells us that the 40-year period of declining interest rates is probably over. The interest rate bounce, which says something important anyway. But more importantly, the value proposition that's established by debt has been that you get paid 300 basis points in a currency where the purchasing power is deteriorating by 8.6%, which suggests to have a real true market interest rates, the interest rates have to continue to rise. Your listeners might be amused to know, or terrified, depending on their point of view, that for most of the last 40 years, the yield on the US 10-year Treasury has been positive. That is, there's been a real yield after inflation. If we were to return to mean then, the four-decade mean, the yield on the US 10-year Treasury would have to yield something like 9 or 9.5. That's reversion to mean. Think about the impact on the economy if interest rates across the board tripled from here. Traditionally, the U.S. 30-year fixed mortgage rate has been marginally higher than the U.S. 10-year treasury rate. So if the U.S. 10-year treasury rate were, say, 9.5, that would suggest a 30-year fixed rate that would be 10, up from 5.2 or 5.3 today. Imagine the impact on housing starts and on the single-family residential market if the 30-year mortgage rate had a double-digit handle on it. Imagine, too, if the credit card interest rate, the median credit card interest rate in the country, the consumer debt interest rate, increased from 11 to its much more common 18. Think of the impact on household budgets where households used debt for consumer durables. Think about the impact on federal, state, and local budgets if the interest charge on government debt tripled, particularly if they tripled in conjunction with federal, state, and local governments having to make larger cash contributions to their pension plans. I think all of these things, sadly, are in the offing.
Yeah, it... You know, since we're talking about, you did an interview with Jake Ducey. This may have been a month or so ago. No, it's probably longer than that. And he basically said that he was renting, expecting the housing market to take a dump, and had been waiting and waiting and waiting. And you essentially said, you know, Jake, try to look at your home. It's not like he was going to buy a rental property and trying to figure if the math would work. This was where him and his family would live. And you said, try to look at your primary residence more as a bet of utility. And when you walk in and you and your wife think, wow, we could live here. And if you can service the debt at a 30-year fixed rate, then take it and kind of, you know, if it's some place that you're going to be living a long time. Can you kind of reiterate your thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, the utility part is pretty much arithmetic. Whether or not you think that home prices are going to go up or down, whichever one you decide, depending on your time frame, you're probably wrong. So you look from a financial point of view at a house by measuring your cost of capital, which is to say the 30-year rate and whether or not it's affordable, relative to your ability to pay. If you reasonably expect, as is the case with Jake, that his ability to pay, his ability to rent is going to increase rapidly. What that means is that his ability to pay increases at the same time that his cost of capital is fixed. But much more importantly, this home isn't a financial asset necessarily. It's partly a financial asset. But he needs to look at the home the way his wife looks at the home. This is going to get me criticism from some of your listeners, but that's okay. Men often have a disjointed relationship with a house, which is that they see it the same way I did. Which is just another asset in an asset stack. But it isn't that. It's a home. It's a sense of security for a family. It's a sense of stability. It is one of the things that you do the work for. And you need to take this intangible utility into consideration when you make the purchase price. I recently myself retired into my dream house, my retired house. And I spent substantially more money than a rational human being would have done from a financial point of view. But I intend, not too soon, to die here. And the enjoyment that I get from sitting in the office where I sit, talking to you, looking across Puget Sound at Mount Baker, is something that reminds me why I worked so hard and why I took so many chances for so many years. When I, you know, have my friends over to enjoy a barbecue out in the yard over Puget Sound, there are some returns that are non-monetary that if you can afford them, are probably good expenditures. And that's what I was trying to tell Jake. Not every one of your listeners is in the circumstance that Jake is in, where he has a unique set of talents and intangible assets around his brand and his channel so that he can be reasonably assured that any house that he would be willing to buy would be easily affordable for him in the next 30 years. And I was trying to explain to Jake that given his particular circumstance, that he needed to take into account non-monetary values too.
There is a lot of peace of mind to owning and not renting.
And, you know, again, I'll get hate for this, but a happy wife is a happy life. You know, there's...
Let them build their nest.
There's two in a family, and, you know, you may as well just acknowledge that.
I like that. Okay. I'm getting a lot of questions on food supply. I've always just kind of had a store of food, but I feel a little more pressure now, and so do my listeners, to stockpile a little more. When you look at Russia and Ukraine, I mean, I could pull up the thing here, but I'm sure you're aware, you know, 20% of, maybe it was almost 30, like wheat, corn, barley, sunflower, a lot of that stuff is coming out of there, and it probably won't be anymore, at least in this foreseeable future. What do you see happening to the food supply in America specifically?
Well, markets work. The world's going to ration by price, which is to say that Americans will do well because we're relatively well, because we're rich by global standards. Rich Americans will do better than poor Americans. That's the way markets work. So we'll ration by price. I think there will be surprises in the food chain, not just because of Russia. There'll be surprises in the food chain because we have mined water. And in big parts of the United States, the western half of the San Joaquin Valley, the Ogallala Aquifer, which extends from sort of South Dakota to west central Texas, we've been using water much more quickly than it has been allowed to replenish itself. So in addition to the fact that we're going to experience this shortages due to geopolitics, we're going to experience shortages because we have produced food in the United States at unsustainably cheap prices with unsustainably subsidized inputs. That's going to be a challenge. We have in the United States and in Canada to a lesser degree run down the beef herd for years and years and years and years and years. And so our ability to grow beef, never mind our ability to finish beef with higher grain prices, will be increasingly constrained. I noted to my amusement on YouTube the other day a grocery store that had tamper-proof security devices on steaks, the same sort of thing that you might have seen on higher value added things other places. But make no mistake, markets work. Upper middle class, and wealthy consumers will be less impacted by global food shortages simply because we are more able than more fragile populations to afford it. It's important to note, too, in the furor involved in higher food prices, that food prices are, by historic norms, extremely cheap. When I turned 21, if my memory serves me correctly, food consumed almost 30% of the average household budget in the United States. Food now consumes 15% of the average household budget. And more of the food that we consume today is provided to us by way of finished products, which is to say meals ready to eat, high value added products, whether or not you appreciate the value that's been added. When I was a kid, you bought groceries. And now when people go to the store, they buy solutions. So when people consider food as a component of their budget, they really need to consider how cheap food is relative to historic norms. And before they bitch, they need to think back to the impact that food had on the budgets of their parents and grandparents.
Really interesting point. That really puts it into perspective. I just bought half a cow. I got a freezer and I'm like, why not? It's probably never going to be cheaper than now. So apparently we have a really good deal on food right now, and it's about to get what it probably should cost.
Substantially less good. Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
I think that's right. You know, I'm talking from the point of view of somebody who can afford it. From the point of view of millions of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck, irrespective of the fact that it's historically cheap, it's going to be unpleasant for them.
Yeah. Okay. What do you see? I've seen some stories on the power grid and how it could be interrupted, rolling brownouts. What are your thoughts on that?
Guarantee. I mean, absolute guarantee. Power distribution in the United States and in the rest of the world has occurred politically, which is to say that we didn't design a grid to take into account the needs of the economy. We designed a grid to accommodate power grabs by various constituencies and various politicians. We don't have an integrated grid and we don't have a smart grid. We don't have a grid that can accommodate the increasing political reliance on politically correct energy, which is to say wind and solar. The challenge with wind and solar, of course, is that they're intermittent, and to access wind and solar on a grid requires substantial redundancy, which is to say you need the ability to provide 160 or 170% of power demanded because of the intermittency of supply. And we don't have the ability, we don't have as addressable a grid as we need. You need to move these supplies from where they exist to where they're needed. A lot of people don't like to live where the wind blows, as an example. And so you need to move that wind from North Dakota to, say, Miami. We probably require, I don't know, $6-8 trillion upgrade. The most important thing that we need to do in our electrical grid, though, is, and the technology exists, make it addressable and make it time and price sensitive, which is to say that electrical power should be extremely cheap at night when it's in short supply, when it's in general supply, and it should become more expensive during periods of peak demand. If you had an addressable grid where people had an incentive to, as an example, invest in batteries so that they could buy power when it was cheap and use it when it was dear, or more importantly, if they lived in the US South and the Southwest, to generate solar power, sell that power in the grid when the grid was short. In other words, if you had a truly distributed market where power was bought by price and sold by price, you wouldn't have an energy shortage in the United States. But we have a political circumstance where addressable power, which is to say a circumstance that asks people to pay for to pay what power is worth, that's unacceptable. And we have a power grid that was built in anticipation of centralized sources of supply with one-way distribution, which is to say the grid has been built to deliver power from nuclear power plants or dams or coal plants out to users. The grid needs to be much more interactive and it needs to be much more addressable. Power is going to come from a whole bunch of places. It's going to go to a whole bunch of places. What the grid needs to do is facilitate a market. Right now, we have a very top-down grid where the big thinkers tell the market where to get the power, what to pay for it, all those types of things. That's not the way markets work.
I'm upgrading the electrical panel. The house I'm in was built in 1948, and nothing's been touched since then. And right. After hearing you say that, maybe I need to invest in some Tesla batteries and some solar panels. That might not be a bad investment.
What part of the country do you live in?
Southern California.
I absolutely think, particularly given the way that Governor Grusom is raping the California taxpayer and ratepayer to subsidize solar, you are either going to accept this transfer payment, which either means you're going to be a party to this theft, or you're going to be a victim of it. Solar doesn't make a lot of sense up where I live in Washington State. We just don't have much sun. But where you all are, particularly given the subsidies, it makes a lot of sense. And it makes it makes marginal sense at today's electricity pricing with today's availability. But I think rolling brownouts and blackouts particularly in California, but really across the country, are a certainty. I don't even think they're a probability. I think they're a certainty. And to the extent that you have the ability on a subsidized basis to shelter yourself from that outcome, particularly if you live in a place like Southern California where the sun shines, I think you really have to look at that. I'm not going to discuss the moral aspects about whether you should steal from your fellow fellow citizens by enjoying an input subsidy or a rate subsidy. That's a very, very, very different question. I'm just talking about recognizing the situation for what it is and understanding the probabilities of increasing costs and decreasing utility from the grid going forward.
I'm sold. But, thank you. Okay. Stimulus checks. Talking with a lot of my friends who are high net worth, multimillionaires, they got stimulus checks. I got one. I feel like the currency is going to people that don't need it, you know? Maybe I'm beating a dead horse here, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I didn't get a stimulus check. Maybe I didn't ask for one. Maybe that's why. But, you know, I've been the benefit, as have other rich people, by incredible political subsidies. Artificially low interest rates is the most important. Middle-class savers received returns on their savings, returns on capital employed, that were scandalously low. People like myself, who had access to credit and the sophistication to use it, enjoyed scandalously low cost of funds. So we had a transfer, a wealth transfer from middle-class savers to rich investors. One function of a democracy, I guess, is to tilt markets. One of the things that we've seen in the last 40 years has been the defense of the interest of spenders over the interest of savers. Spenders, of course, being very numerous and savers being fairly scarce. Artificially low interest rates are really government's way of picking a winner in the war between spenders and savers. People like myself, who don't spend very much money on their lifestyle on consumer goods because we don't care much, are still a beneficiary, because to the extent that I, as an example, buy commercial real estate at the 30-year fixed rates that existed 3 or 4 years ago, where my cost of capital stayed the same and were subsidized, and my return on capital employed increased, that to me was more important than any shitty little stimulus check that President Trump could possibly have sent me. I'm not trying to say that I like the fact that they charged me a bunch of tax to send out meaningless stimulus checks, in effect bribing the citizenry with their own money. But I'm very cognizant of the fact that I was the beneficiary of a much larger stimulus check as a consequence of quantitative easing and artificially low interest rates.
Yeah, I Jason Hartman, I don't know if you know him or not.
I do.
Okay, yeah. He said, I'll never forget this. I put it on TV for the guys at work to see this, and he said that interest rates are the lowest. Now, this was a year ago. Interest rates are the lowest that they've been in 5,000 years,
right,
in the history of money. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, that's impressive.
Well, think for a second, Steve, about negative interest rates. These aren't a force of nature. Negative interest rates means that you, as a saver, forego consumption in hopes of spending the money later. And you lend the money to me so that I can consume now. And as a consequence of taking both the credit risk and foregoing consumption, you get penalized. Now, nobody would do this of their own volition. This is a construct of man. This is not a force of nature. The idea that the currency is deteriorating, the purchasing power is deteriorating, depending on the number you took, but let's use the government's number, 8.6%. And you are being compensated as a saver in a time deposit at 0.6%, or lending to the U.S. government at 3%. nobody in their right mind, in the right set of circumstances, would do that. Why would you take credit risk? Why would you defer consumption against the guarantee of a reduction in purchasing power? So you need to look at the interest rates in the sense that this is a historic anomaly, which must ultimately revert to mean.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to oil. Myself and my followers bought oil when it was almost free, right after the COVID crash. I've trimmed a bit of my position, almost kind of wishing I hadn't. I get a lot of questions whether we should sell. I guess my outlook now is, well, if you're going to hang on for another 2 or 3 years, then probably don't and enjoy the dividends. And if not, then I suppose so. I don't know. Is that accurate? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on who you are and what type of oil stocks you own. If you are an investor, a real investor, and if you're looking to increase your wealth or hedge your energy consumption over time, the oil stocks are still inexpensive relative to the oil price. I believe that the oil price goes lower because I believe that markets work. I believe that $120, $130 oil eventually will destroy some demand. But I also believe that the oil and gas companies in the United States are discounting $70 oil and $4 gas in a world where oil is selling for $115 and gas is selling for $8. In other words, there's room for substantial deterioration. If you regard yourself as more a trader, more a speculator, a nearer term investor, and if the oil companies in your portfolio are of lower quality, 3 years ago, I recommended a basket of 7 Canadian oil stocks. Those stocks are up cumulatively 250 or 300%. It makes an awful lot of sense to sell enough of that basket that you have recouped all your capital, paid your taxes, and you can hold the balance come what may in a riskless circumstance. But for many of the clients that I used to advise when I was active in wealth management, the idea that you could hold the best asset allocators in the oil and gas space, say the Exxon Mobils, and maybe enjoy great leverage to the renaissance in U.S. oil production through Occidental, the Occidental-Anadarko merger, and maybe participate in continued strength in the American natural gas business by owning Devon. If you believe in the sort of secular nature of the extractive industries and energy in particular, and if you're yield sensitive, there's a real case to maintain some or all of your position in the higher quality oil and gas names.
ExxonMobil, BP, ConocoPhillips.
I wouldn't go that far. I'd okay. go in the big ones. I'd go to the real high quality names. I'd go to Chevron. I'd go to Exxon. I would be less inclined to own the European names personally. BP has cast themselves as beyond petroleum, which I don't think is a real good idea. I look for companies that have exhibited spending discipline, companies that are generating substantial free cash flow. And by free cash flow, I mean cash flow after sustaining capital. You look at Exxon, even during quarters when they were losing money, they have invested twice their after-tax earnings in maintaining production, while at the same time being able to maintain very generous dividends. What they've done is, in effect, taken the depletion and depreciation charges and taken advantage of extraordinarily low interest rates to strengthen their balance sheet, increase their production capabilities, make the long-term investments necessary to maintain production 10 years and beyond. They've just done an absolutely exemplary job. It's interesting to hear Mr. Biden's criticism of them when, in fact, they lost money in 4 of the last 11 quarters, earned $40 billion and invested $80 billion. should the federal government be so efficient and so aggressive?
Okay. I want to talk about uranium. You're probably one of the world's experts on it. You mentioned in jest on another show that you could probably profitably trade uranium by simply watching how many views your interviews get and buy or sell depending on that. So if you get a whole bunch of views, then it's probably time to trim. If you get very few, then it's probably time to buy. So by that logic, I'm hoping that this interview gets three views and then I'll back up the truck. I've been slowly tranching in with a little bit more uranium every couple of weeks on these downtrends. What do you think?
If you have a five-year time frame, it's a no-brainer. I mean, absolutely no-brainer. I'm delighted to see the spot price of uranium decline. I'm happier yet to see the smaller uranium equities decline in price. They got way, way, way ahead of themselves. When you describe me as a uranium expert, I'm actually a uranium beneficiary. If you look back to what happened to my own portfolio in the last uranium bull market, it was the stuff of legend. It was really, really, really wonderful. And it taught me a lot about markets. And what did Yogi Berra say? Deja vu all over again. We're in a situation now where globally we're using about 200 million pounds. And that number is increasing fairly rapidly.
It's 200. Wow, I thought it was 180, and I think that was only a few months ago. Okay.
And we're producing 120 million pounds, which means there's an 80 million pound deficit. Now, there is surplus production capacity, largely at Kazatomprom and Cameco, of about 35 million pounds. So some of that deficit can go to deficit heaven in 18 months. But both Kazatomprom and Cameco have said, and I believe them in this circumstance, that they won't return that production to the market until they have contracted sufficient long-term volumes at prices high enough to generate reasonable shareholder returns on capital employed, which is to say there's going to be supply discipline. Now, there's two pieces of arithmetic that your subscribers are going to have to suffer through. The first is production cost. And by that, I don't mean all in sustaining costs. I mean total production costs in terms, including cost of capital, and the cost of prior year write-downs, which are expensive. In that context, the global price of uranium, the global cost, pardon me, of uranium is about $60 a pound. Well, the spot price of uranium is $46 a pound. Let's say if you blend the spot and term market, that the real market for uranium is closer to $50 a pound. The industry is making uranium, 120 million pounds of it, at $60 a pound, and selling almost 200 million pounds at $50 a pound.
I like that.
So the deficit's a problem, and the fact that the industry on a total cost basis is losing $1.2 billion a year needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed for a different reason, too, because that cost number, that $60 number, relates to existing supplies. New supplies, where you have time delays, permitting delays, you have inflation in input costs, cement, steel, time value of money. It's estimated that the incentive price to bring on new production, and we will have to bring on new production given the supply deficit, is more like $70 to $75 a pound. So my belief is that at least within the five-year time frame, the price of uranium absolutely positively needs to go through $75 in order for the lights not to go off. So we have a circumstance where it's highly probable that the price clears up from at least 46 to 75, probably overshoots because higher prices don't generate more near-term supply. They generate more long-term supply. And there's two catalysts that cause this to come into focus. The first has been the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which has taken, 55 million pounds that was overhanging.
Last I saw it was 56.
Okay, 56.
Yeah.
Some number. Taking it off the market. This isn't supply. At least it isn't supply at market. I mean, maybe if somebody bid spot bid Sprott, pardon me, a 20% premium to the spot market. They'd liquidate the trust and give out the pounds, but that seems unlikely. So the overhang that everybody talks about is beginning to be eaten away by investors represented by Sprott. At the same time, on a global basis, we consume more uranium now than we did pre-Fukushima. And our consumption, ex-Japan, is increasing rapidly. And finally, and this is the most important piece of the puzzle, the political winds in Japan now favor a restart. I've been saying for 5 years that you'd see a move in the uranium price when you saw the pace of Japanese restarts increase. I just didn't know what year that was going to take place. It turns out I do now. It's 2022 and 2023. And a restart, a feasible restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet takes probably 50 million pounds of inventory out of the held for sale category, takes it into the fuel category, and it increases consumption, admittedly a double count, by 10 million pounds a year. Increases in demand of 10 million pounds a year that take place in 2023 are much more important to the price than increases in demand that would take place in 2033. When everybody looks at the pace of, as an example, Chinese builds, they're encouraging, they're attractive, but they're nowhere near as important as restarts that take pounds out of the market now.
Yeah, yeah. The Chinese, they're not going to be up and running with the ones they're doing for another decade or so, right?
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, they're building lots of plants, but yeah. When people talk about 150 plants, what they're talking about is a build-out cycle over 20 years. What the Japanese are talking about is restarting, you know, something.
The plants
like,
are already there. They just need to open them up and feed them.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah, okay. Get to work. Just get to work.
What you're saying about the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, the SPUT, the Uranium Conference 4.0 by Bloor Street Capital, amazing. It was 4 hours long. John Shpaglia spoke at the World Nuclear Fuel Market Conference in Montreal recently. And it was really kind of neat to hear it from the horse's mouth. He said he really had to illustrate to the fuel buyers, the people that are buying the uranium, that Sprott has no interest in selling uranium to the market. And he said that there was, and I'm going to quote here, this lingering perception that somehow the trust is going to have this material available to them, either for sale or for potential lending. And he had to let them know that that's a bad assumption, and they have no interest in doing that. And that seemed to be, from at least the way he worded it, that was surprising to them.
I need to first of all tell your listeners that while I am still the largest shareholder of Sprott and the Sprott director, I'm not a spokesman for Sprott. John Shpaglia no longer reports to me. But we received very clear instructions from the investment community that this product was to be operated in a way that served the interest of investors rather than the utility industry. So to the extent that the utility industry views this 56 million pounds of uranium as inventory available to them, that isn't the case. This is inventory that's held on behalf of several hundred thousand investors who agree with me in terms of the price assumption associated with uranium. And so I think Mr. Champaglia's discussion with the industry was useful. There hasn't been a vehicle in the uranium business like SPUT ever. There have been inventories of uranium which have been held by traders, as an example. There have been financial players which have used their balance sheet to facilitate the difference between the spot market and the long-term market. I'm thinking about Orrin Benton and Nuexco going back into the 1990s. But there has never been a vehicle that was designed to create a financial interest in uranium separate and apart from its utility application. And so now the largest uranium inventory in the world, and probably the fastest growing uranium inventory in the world, is a financial inventory rather than inventory held by traders. It's worthwhile to note too, when you look at inventory held by traders, that the traders are generally capital light. which is to say that they financed as much as 80% of the cost of their inventory. And so the cost of their inventory rises consistently. in the case of Sprott, it's all bought and paid for, thank you. So there's a very different beast loose in the market now, which is something that the industry has to understand. They, meaning the utilities, have viewed the Sprott inventories as spot inventories. They've viewed it as surplus pounds because it hadn't been consumed as fuel. In the intermediate future, it's not going to be consumed as fuel.
I like that. I like that a lot. It's pretty cool going on the website too and entering in how many shares you got and see exactly how many pounds. It's kind of neat.
It's very interesting. You know, if I might belabor this a little bit, the other thing that the Sprott product has done is that it has brought liquidity and clarity rather than opacity to the spot market. The spot market in uranium was a treacherous place to go for information. I know because I went there for 50 years. That's not true, 30 years. But the spot market was, first of all, highly illiquid. There were days where there were no trades in the spot market, and there were periods where 6 weeks passed before there was any decent liquidity, at least reported liquidity in the market. And there were very large differences between spot price and availability between, say, Canada and France and Singapore. Now, with the spot product, millions of shares trade every day. And there is, in addition to liquidity, complete transparency, not opacity. I would argue, frankly, and by the way, Sprott can affect location swaps. It doesn't matter to us if we hold our yellow cake at Coverdyne in the United States, or if we hold it up in Canada, or we hold it in France. So if Cameco needs a million pounds in France for a French delivery, they deliver the uranium to us in Port Hope, Ontario, and we sell our inventory out in France. So that Sprott product, means really that the Sprott product itself is the spot market. The spot market is no longer the spot market. The Sprott market is the spot market. The liquidity, the transparency, and the transferability in the uranium market has all changed as a consequence of this product. And the industry has been very slow to recognize that.
I didn't realize how slow until I listened to that interview with Jim Pagley, and I'm like, wow, these are the people that are buying it.
There is a big US utility who will go unnamed that was telling me 6 weeks ago that we were an ETF. And as demand for uranium and the price fell, that we would have to sell to satisfy redemptions. This is a big utility. And I said, well, sir, in fact, no. This is a trust. This is a closed-end fund. And when uranium goes in there, from your point of view, it went to uranium heaven. We don't have redemptions. In our physical gold and silver products, yes, we have redemptions. Investors, at least large investors, can redeem their shares and we give them physical gold and silver. But for fairly obvious reasons, we're not going to ship a can of yellow cake home with an investor to store in his or her basement upon surrender of a share. In this particular vehicle, material only goes in, it doesn't come out.
Yeah, that'd be a good way to lose your hair. I'm part of Silver Chartist, and Jeff Clark, he did an interview recently, and he said Russian sanctions on uranium are coming. He seemed very certain on this. How do you feel?
Oh, I think sanctions are coming. I don't think they'll matter. You know, the sanctions will matter to the sanctimonious, which is to say that, you know, maybe some French utilities and U.S. utilities and German utilities, well, there aren't any more German nuclear utilities, but you get the point. They may observe sanctions, and there may be some self-sanctioning for political purposes. Will China participate? Will Japan participate? Will India participate? Absolutely not. The Russians will have to sell their material for much less than the spot market. There are reports now that Russian crude oil cargoes go for a 30% discount to Brent, but they get sold. The Russians just get less, and the countries that, for whatever reasons they have, don't observe the sanctions, get a benefit. The challenge in the uranium market will be in enrichment capacity, enrichment
because services. Like 40% of it is done in Russia, correct?
40% of it is done in Russia, and their principal consumers are Western utilities. And there, in terms of re-enrichment and enrichment capacity, the sanctions will matter. Now, what will happen is that it'll increase demand for primary fuel if there's less enriched or re-enriched capacity. The market will overfeed, which is to say that they will substitute primary fuel for re-enriched fuel, and they'll make the fuel work a little bit harder rather than ship it for re-enrichment. And that will matter. But other than psychologically, I don't think that sanctions on Russian nuclear fuel will matter much. And I certainly don't think they'll work. The Chinese, I think, will look at the sanctions and say, you guys sanction whatever you want. We're going to buy the best fuel from the lowest offer available. The idea that we still live in a unipolar world and that the United States directs the activities of all humankind, a very outdated view of things.
So if we sanction the enrichment and like that from Russia, what effect would that have on our uranium holdings?
Not much.
Not much.
Okay. Not much. I think you would increase demand for primary fuel marginally, simply because there was less substitution for enriched fuel, and you would make primary fuel work a little bit harder, which is to say you wouldn't ship it for enrichment until you'd sucked a few more molecules out of it. But I don't think overall it will make any near as much difference as the pace of Japanese restarts.
Can you give your quick, a few minutes on gold and silver, where you see that right now? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm delighted, first of all, with gold and silver prices. I'd like to own more. And the fact that they're staying within price ranges that I think are attractive are wonderful. I've beat this horse to death, but for the benefit, if it's a benefit, of those of your listeners who haven't heard this soliloquy before, it goes like this. I think that gold and silver prices go higher. I think it's a probability rather than a certainty, but I think it's so for various reasons that are well-grounded in history. Precious metals prices do well during periods of time when savers and investors are concerned about the purchasing power of conventional savings instruments denominated in fiat currencies, in particular, the US dollar, the world's reserve currency. So investors and savers need then to consider why they might be nervous about conventional instruments. The first reason would, of course, be quantitative easing, which is to say counterfeiting. Whether or not you agree with the policy implications of counterfeiting, printing more currency units devalues the existing stock of currency. There's no way of getting around that. But a more pernicious cause for concern would be debt and deficits. That is to say, credit quality. If you're a buyer of US dollar denominated securities, particularly US dollar denominated debt securities, you need to consider the fact that the federal government on balance sheet owes $30 trillion, or only $23 trillion net of their balance sheet, which is to say net of counterfeiting. But more importantly, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the net present value of our off-balance sheet liabilities, not the aggregate, but rather the net present value of our off-balance sheet liabilities, exceeds $125 trillion. This is things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, Pension Benefit Guarantee Board. So at the federal level, before state and local debt, the U.S. federal government owes folks $145 trillion and counting. They propose to service that debt with a budget that's in deficit $2 trillion a year, which is to say, rather than service it, they add to it every year. If you're a lender, which is what a saver is, you can't help but be concerned, if you're rational, by a debtor that has no hope of paying back his or her debt. But it's the third element that I think really over time damages confidence in savings instruments and fiat currencies. That's negative interest rates. The absolute government guarantee that you will lose money. If you loan money to the US government in the most liquid security in the world, the US 10-year treasury, you receive 3% interest in a currency that's depreciating in terms of purchasing power by 8.6%. You are absolutely positively guaranteed by your government at least a 5% annual loss in purchasing power. The first promise they've made me in my life that I'm certain they're going to keep. My friend Jim Grant calls the U.S. 10-year treasury return-free risk. And I would suggest to you that gold is fighting a war against return-free risk, which is a war that even if they don't win it, they will lose less badly. And they'll lose it less badly for two primary reasons. The first is that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related assets, despite the tailwinds that it enjoys, is the lowest in my lifetime. Precious metals related investments comprise less than 0.5% of the savings and investment assets in the United States, while the four decade mean approaches 1.5% or 2%. So if, as a consequence of quantitative easing, debt and deficits and negative real interest rates, interest in precious metals only reverts to mean, demand somewhere between triples and quadruples. And I think that happens for the following reasons. For the last 40 years, through a period of declining interest rates and benign economic climate, a strong US dollar, the biggest investors in the world, the pension funds, the endowments, sovereign wealth funds, have had an asset allocation spread that was roughly 60% equities, which did well, 40% debt, which did very well. Now you have a circumstance where the biggest investors in the world have 40% of their assets in an asset class, long debt, which is guaranteed to lose money, guaranteed to obviate any ability that they might have to meet the obligations of their savers and pension holders. Imagine that you are a very large pension plan, and imagine that 40% of your assets are in long debt. And imagine that you are receiving 3% interest while your liabilities are increasing by 8.6% compounded. And you're doing that by 40% of the corpus of your managed estate. You have to do something about it. You have to do something about it. And this disintermediation that has to happen in the bond market, I'm not trying to say that 40% of every pension fund will be invested in gold. I'm just saying that enough of the product of this disintermediation will likely be invested in an asset class that has a millennia-long reputation for sheltering investors from depreciation of purchasing power, that demand for precious metals-related assets at least reverts to mean. Now, imagine yourself what a tripling or quadrupling of investment demand for precious metals and precious metals-related securities might do to the market.
Okay, you do portfolio reviews of natural resource stocks. No crypto, no correct. Pot stocks, just natural resource stocks. Stick to your strength. I've done this several times, and it's pretty humbling when you think you're sending nothing but gold to you, and it turns out that it gets, you know, one is the best rating, 10 is the worst, and you throw a few fives and sixes in there. I'm like, man, I did not see that coming. Can we do a couple here and sure. Kind of give people an idea of what?
Yep, we have to do it. We have to do it very quickly because I have to be smart somewhere else in 4 minutes.
All right, you know what? We'll leave that one for the listener. Then let's talk real quick about Boca Raton.
I've put on investment conferences now for 30 years. This will be my 28th live conference. We had two that were video. Several things about it. The first is, unlike any other investment conference in the world, it comes with a 100% money back guarantee. If you think for whatever reason that you didn't get your money's worth, I'll give you your money back. I've put on good enough conferences for 30 years that I've had to refund substantially less than 0.5% of the tuitions that I've raised over 30 years. How does this work? We have fantastic big picture macro thinkers, people that you wouldn't see on CNBC or in the Wall Street Journal. Jim Rickards, Daniela DiMartino Booth, Grant Williams, people
Robert
of that.
Robert Friedland.
Robert Friedland. Well, I'm going to mention Friedland later. But in addition to these big picture thinkers, we have wonderful analysts who can say, if you agree with this view of the world, that's all well and good, but that's academic. Here's what you do with your money. More importantly, we have the living legends. We have a group of entrepreneurs who comes back and speaks year after year after year to our attendees. These living legends are the Ross Beaties of the world, the people who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from standing starts. And they don't just brag. They tell you how they built the companies and why the lessons that they learned are important to them as investors and can be important to you as investors. This is really where the rubber meets the road. This is the inside information. In addition to that, at most investment conferences, exhibitors are regarded as advertisers. That is a source of fee revenue. My attendees for 30 years have told me that my exhibitors were content. They were opportunities. The consequence of that is that while at most investment conferences, the qualification to be an attendee, an exhibitor, is a check that cashes. At my conference, to be an exhibitor, a public company exhibitor, you have to be owned in an account managed or co-managed by myself. That doesn't mean, sadly, Steve, that every stock I ever buy goes up. What it does mean is that each one of the exhibitors has been vetted thoroughly enough that I have my own capital at risk. The best guarantee that I have your interest as an attendee at heart. Be July 26th through 29th in Boca Raton, Florida. I assume you're going to post a link.
There'll be a link in the show notes, yes.
Great.
Yes.
And as to the portfolio ranking, any of your listeners who care about my thoughts as to their natural resource portfolios are invited to go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks. Please no pot stocks, please no crypto stocks, please no tech stocks. I'll rank them 1 to 10 as you suggest. My rankings are very hard. If you want some more information about my conference, in the notes, write conference. If you care about my bank, write bank. If you care about the private placements I'm doing with my own money, I'm not soliciting because I no longer take commissions, write placements. Once again, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, ranking, bank, conference, placements. Look forward to hearing from anybody who cares.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mr. Rule. This is a real pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Steve. I look forward to doing it again. I look forward to seeing you in Boca.
Yes. All right. You have a good one, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
All right.